Spectrum is a word that means a gamut, a range of things and how you program it. Did someone say program? It's one of those too. Spectrum West. It's all about you. Howdy. This is where the arts and culture of West Wisconsin congregates and communicates. Thanks for finding a place in the audience. I'm Al Ross. This week, Ellen White. She sings up a storm and has brought her talent to West Wisconsin annually to become a favorite of ours. Well, she lives in Portland, and Portland has been in the news a lot, so we decided to get her perspective on things, and you'll get a positive earful. Jim Oliver and Eau Claire native son Neil Griffin discuss his fourth novel, Burden of Truth, in a long-distance phone conversation from Southern California. The Heidi Center is our latest arts and entertainment venue to check up on. Got to see how they're doing, where they're going, and when. Director Deb Johnson is our guest. And let's kick off our second September show right here. Next time someone suggests you take a hike, just grin and say, gladly, I have just the books I need to make it completely enjoyable. And you now can add to your library with a new book, the 27th in a string of tips on memorable hikes. This one called Wisconsin's Best Autumn Hikes by Menominee native and very traveled guy, Rob Bignell. The 27th book, what have you learned about what people want? And has hiking changed?
Yeah, well, I don't think hiking has changed much at all, other than maybe the materials used to make equipment. You know, like trekking poles are no longer wooden. They're, you know, made out of special fibers and composites and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, hike is a hike. You get out in the woods and you just start walking. All my books up to this point have just been about regions. I wanted to do some more topical books. Just thought autumn leaves would be perfect.
Your list of the 10 best in Wisconsin includes some familiar names, places we all may have gone at some time. What's the difference between visiting a place like, let's use Holy Hill as an example, or one of the several state parks on your favorites list? What's the difference between visiting it and actually hiking it?
So, you know, if you go to visit a place like, say, Holy Hill, you're looking at more of the spiritual experience of going into the Basilica. Sure. Whereas if you hike it, you're going down into the Ice Age Trail, which is below the hill itself. So if you're at Holy Hill, at the Basilica itself, looking down, you're probably looking at other things than nature or autumn leaves, though certainly you'll see the glory if you go up into the towers, because you're looking down at the valley where the Ice Age Trail runs. The beauty of hiking, though, is you're underneath the trees. You're in the canopy, and you come to vista points, so you can look up the hill and see the Basilica at the top. So a little different experience, because you're actually in the trees and under the canopy rather than looking at it from a vista.
The first chapter of your book, if you can call it a chapter, asks the question, why hike in autumn? Are the answers obvious, like the weather and the scenery, or are there other hidden gems there?
Sure, yeah. Well, the weather's the obvious advantage. It's much drier in autumn than it would be at any other time of the year. You lack the humidity usually in autumn. Mm-hmm. Temperatures are a little cooler, so you can probably go farther or go up a hill without breaking much of a sweat, comparatively to summer, for example. But the other advantage of hiking in fall is as the leaves change and begin to fall off, you get to see different things that you wouldn't see, say, during the summer. Leaves often are hiding rock formations around here that we have. So we have lots of sandstone formations and cuts and boulders that were left by the last ice age as well. And some of that gets hidden, so you get to see that. In addition, you get to see some different vistas, sight lines that you wouldn't see in summer as well because they're blocked off.
I like the fact that your guidebook also has suggestions, some of them possibly life-preserving in nature. Clothing, what to watch out for, that kind of stuff.
Right, yeah, absolutely. You should always layer your clothing whenever you go out hiking. You know, in summer, obviously, you probably can get away with wearing shorts and a T-shirt. But when it comes to fall, weather changes. It can change within a day. You have a nice sunny morning, and it looks bright, and you can just go out in a T-shirt and shorts, and suddenly it can get real cool in the afternoon, or you can even get rain. So I always recommend layering your clothing as much as you possibly can. A good pair of hiking boots is useful as well, because some of the terrain does get a little muddy at times, or can get rocky if you're attempting to climb up a hill or hike up a hill. We have lots of sandstone and limestone that breaks off easily.
The book is called Wisconsin's Best Autumn Hikes. It's one of many produced by Rob Bignell. He's our guest, and we thank him for driving up a hill for better cell phone service. So, Rob, can people find themselves a little bit overconfident today? They're carrying a cell phone. People can come to depend on those for not only photographs, which are nice, but for GPS, and they, right. they have compasses on them. Are good old standbys like maps and compasses still a good idea?
Yeah, I always recommend you carry at least a paper map, and you probably should have a compass with you as well. You know, it's easy to drop your cell phone. It's easy to lose your cell phone. Yeah. And then what do you do at that point? Cell phones are great. GPS are awesome, obviously. Service to use. I use GPS. But there are times when you do get out in the remoter sections and you don't have any kind of service.
Yeah.
With my book, for all the feature trails, you can actually go online and print out an 8x11 map that shows you all the contour lines and has a little yellow line showing where the trail goes through. And then you don't have to worry about getting lost if you've got a map and you've got a compass.
Yeah.
The side thing is if you do get lost, the map is great for starting a little campfire to keep you warm at night.
Yes.
The map didn't do you any good anyway, right?
So, there you go.
But I'm only joking.
Sinking feeling to be out in the boonies and look down at your phone and see it doesn't have a signal.
Absolutely.
I'll bet, yeah. I hope, Rob, it's just me, but because organizations have adopted highways and things, irresponsible folks seem to be littering a bit more than I remember in years past. You talk about leave no trace, which is a mantra that everyone should adhere to. It seems to be being replaced by, look, we ate at McDonald's. How are people doing leaving no trace?
Yeah, and it's not just litter, but general vandalism. You can look at it as vandalism. People spray paint on rocks, for example, carve their names and initials and so on into trees and even into the fire towers themselves. But anytime you spray paint or you toss litter out, what you're doing is you're ruining the experience for someone else.
Right.
And it's just a simple matter of common courtesy. You don't want to see that when you go hiking. So if you don't do it and others don't do it, all of us will have a great experience when we're out there. Really best not to bring that type of stuff out there anyway. You know, things like soda, for example, dehydrate you when you're out on the trail. It's much better just to bring water. And it's best not to bring foods that are in plastic containers, because if you toss plastic out, other animals can ingest that or will chew on it or eat on it and so on. And when they do, of course, they get sick, potentially even die.
Of all the counsel you offer, it appears to me as if four words might be premier. Stay on the trail.
Right, yeah. Yep, toes on the trail, stay on the trail. Absolutely, yeah. In Wisconsin, when you're going up and down hills, you'll notice that it gets muddy sometimes if we've just had a rain in the last day or two. It's very easy for trails to wash out and wash away when there's nothing holding them down, when there's no grass or tree roots holding them down. So if you go off the trail, what you're basically doing is stomping on the low-lying plants and the grass, creating another trail, and that just creates more area for the trail to be washed out. And that just makes it difficult for the next hiker who's going up to be able to get to the top. It can even close trail sometimes if we get a heavy enough storm and washes it out. So contributing to that erosion effect may not seem significant in the short run, but in the long run, and especially if we have a good storm, the combined efforts of everybody going off the trail has a significant impact and effect.
It's his 27th hiking guidebook, Wisconsin's Best Autumn Hikes. Rob Bignell with us. You have several pages designated to trees and their fall costumes, and you have some cool things to do with leaves in the book.
Right, yeah. You know, I think when you take kids out on the trail, it's easy for some of them to get distracted. Some of them really just enjoy being out in nature and being excited by what they see. Whereas for others, it may not be the most exciting thing compared to the video game that you took them away from, or their cell phone that you took them away from when you went out there.
Yeah.
So the idea is to keep kids involved and teach them a little bit about the environment, about the trail that they're on, so they can grow to appreciate it, and to keep them from getting bored and getting a little unruly. Now, the great thing, though, is even adults can play those games, and I know some adults who do. They go out and do the exact same thing that we recommend for the kids' games, and it's lots of fun to do. Yeah. Great for romantic date, for example.
Yep. So it's time, because fall is coming on and the colors will be here soon, to get your book. Where can we get this book and all your books?
Sure. Yeah. Well, we're still lining up a number of bookstores that will provide it. I know we've got Valley Booksellers down in Baraboo has got copies coming in. Bookends on Main and Menominee will have a copy or two. But in the rest of the state, you can just simply go online and it will be at Amazon.com. There's an ebook version. And then there's the paperback, which is in full color, and that version is available.
Rob Bignell, thanks. Appreciate it.
You bet, absolutely. Thanks, Al.
The latest in the Bignell sequence of books to help us enjoy life, Wisconsin's best autumn hikes. Enjoy it, and enjoy getting out. Coming up on Spectrum West, Ellen White sings and tells us what life is like in Portland, including the fires that have added to their challenge. Jim Oliver is here with author Neil Griffin as well. Oh, Pat Donahue in the background there. Like all our marvelous venues, the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls continues to roll with the pandemic punches. They're keeping things on their calendar right up to 11th-hour deadlines, canceling, postponing, or in some cases, finding a way to make things happen. Deb Johnson is executive director. I reached her on Tuesday. Before we talk about serious stuff, I found out you can really do the twist. There's a video of you at the bottom of the stairs and another gal at the top of the stairs. You got a little chubby checker going and you're shucking and jiving.
We are. You know, when the building was empty and quiet and we were working on other things, it was one of those nice things to reach out and say, you know, the arts are still there and we're still here and we're not giving up. And if it makes your day, makes you want to get up and do a little dancing, that's great.
Let's talk a little bit of history, because I didn't realize the timeline, because I am more impressed now that the Heidi Center came back after so long. I mean, the building was closed in 1964.
Correct.
When the new McDonald High School was built. The CVCA itself as a group wasn't formed until 12 years later in 76, and it took another double-digit years before renovation began. So all told, that building was closed for 36 years.
Yes.
Before reopening in 2000. That's a long time.
That is an amazing long time. And, you know, what do you do with 30,000 square feet of space if you're not using it? It just goes to rot and kids get in and roofs leak and windows break. And, yeah, it was a mess.
I'll bet you there's volumes of photographs before and after.
Yes. We have several books here at the Heidi Center. People can come through and look.
36 years. I guess I knew it was closed for a while. I mean, that's more than a while.
Yes.
Well, a rather unfortunate time for things to go awry, this being your 20th season. What has it been like since March? I'm guessing that nearly every day must contain something you did not expect.
Right. It's amazing that once the genie's out of the bottle and you have performances that have been publicized, how hard it is to cancel, reschedule, contact everyone, let them know, keep in touch with. We still have things in October, in November, in December that we are trying to hold on to and just keeping in touch with them. It took a lot just to do that. That was our first couple, 3 weeks when things were shut down. We shut down the day after a very successful Kalan performance. Mm. And, the next day everybody was told to shut down.
Everybody remembers that day or that week in March, don't they?
Yes, they do.
When we were young, adults warned that if you crossed your eyes, they might stay that way. I wonder if the same holds true about fingers, because directors of venues must have fingers crossed every time a make-or-break deadline approaches, you know?
It is really hard, because you can't read the future. And in March, when we started canceling things, I'm like, well, it definitely cannot last throughout the summer. And look at it, what a joke it's made of that. What we've learned to do is make plans A, B, and C.
Okay.
So you really are treating everything as in, okay, if it works the way we want it to, here's plan A. If not, what's another date? What are we going to do? How are we going to handle this as it gets closer? So it gives me a sense of control in a very unclear, uncontrollable setting, because I can't work harder to change COVID. I can't, you know, spend more time or make more plans to change what may or may not happen in November. And that's about as far as I feel we can feel and plan.
And you've had to work with producers in ways that you've never had to work before, I'm sure. Some shout outs to people who are being just as flexible as you are.
Yes, and I'm telling you, a touring musician, the agents that go with it, they are getting hit just as hard, if not harder, as they see entire tours. Even if they wanted to tour, the venues aren't open. They're not even able to make it worth their while, even if there is a venue open. You know, they have been incredible, innovative. We have a virtual concert coming up. It was Common Chords, and they were going to be here, but now they are doing something with tips and sharing it with the venues. I mean, that was incredible, and they've got the technology down. We didn't have that kind of live stream technology at all. Yeah, I have to appreciate everybody that has just been incredible working with us and then working to make best that we can out of a bad situation.
She's executive director of the Heidi Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. That's Deb Johnson on the phone with us. And you may hear me rustling papers as we talk every once in a while, because I have a list of things that are coming up. But before we look down the road a little bit, what is definitely on and what is definitely off and what is in limbo, let's talk about, because this show airs on Thursday, let's talk about what's happening this evening. Tell us about it.
For the past 2 years, we've had a dinner over the Duncan that people have really appreciated. The first year, it was outside. It was great. The second year, it had to be moved inside because it was actually storming pretty badly, but it was snug and cozy. Mm-hmm. Then we were going to do it again this year, and people were just not buying tickets, not feeling comfortable with that, sitting out all together. We understand that. Then someone who was going to call in and get tickets, she said, oh, I understand, but have you thought about doing it to go? It took off like wildfire. People have been getting their tickets for this gourmet meal done by Sweet Clarice Catering and mm-hmm. packaged by wonderful Chippewa Falls High Seniors. And so it's been going really well. But a couple of our board members thought, you know, what about our supporters? We have volunteers. We have supporters and people that aren't able to come up because they feel compromised, even for the stuff that we do have going. Mm-hmm. They're housebound. They're maybe ill. They're maybe not comfortable. Let's give meals to them. That has been so humbling, as people are so appreciative, so looking forward to it because they're not able to get out. But this meal being delivered to their house, they're looking forward to it so much tonight that I just forget how easy it is to make somebody's day.
And by the time our conversation reaches people's ears, the deadline for ordering dinners will have passed because it is, I believe, Wednesday, 5 o'clock.
Correct.
But at least we're talking about some of the things that are going on and going out, I guess. So that's what we want to make sure that people understand, is you're figuring out ways to do things. So, all right, the next thing I see on the calendar is scheduled for next weekend. That's probably not going to happen. The Over the River and Through the Woods.
We are still moving on with that.
It's not usual that I like being proven wrong, but I like being proven wrong in that instance.
Taking some lessons from the Eau Claire Children's Theater.
Oh, good.
The director and the cast and crew have been working on it and practicing safe distancing, but also doing the rehearsals. We probably won't get the numbers that we normally would, but we'll have a very safe and wonderful experience for those people that do want to come out.
Friday and Saturday evenings at 7:30, Sunday at 2.
It's a play about two sets of grandparents who want to keep their grandson close, but he wants to take a job across the country. So all kinds of fun, and they're trying to figure out ways that they can keep him close, including food and games and a young woman that they're trying to get him interested in.
How about your 20th anniversary celebration on the 26th?
That has unfortunately been postponed.
All right, that was the Robenzer family and friends.
Yes.
The next event is all the way into mid-October. From then on, I'm guessing those are things that are still penciled in and you're just going to wait and see?
The Swearingen and Kelly has been postponed. They actually have COVID themselves. So,
oh, boy.
Yeah, and they're not going to travel until they feel really comfortable. And then we have the virtual concert on the 24th, so that was going to be here, but that's gone virtual. And the Ghost in the Attic, the murder mystery, we're still hoping to have that. We've got a podcast that is actually going to be in October that'll lead up to this Ghost in the Attic. The podcast is called Ghosted. So, yeah, we've been busy. I think what's really important for people to remember is we're not going to go away. We're not giving up. but we have a mission. It's not just to keep the building open. It's not just to keep our staff employed. We have a mission that we want to keep pushing towards. And so this podcast, it is done by a team out of the UW-Eau Claire, and there are a lot of people that are into urban myths and true crime and things like that that are happening in Wisconsin. So Ghosted is a podcast. It'll be a limited series that we're getting behind because it's one thing we can do virtually.
You have some workshops, too, the September ones.
Yes.
How about workshops and seminars and those kinds of things?
So we do have a colored pencil intermediate that is going to still go on. That has enough people to keep it going in September. In October, we had to change a few of them because the instructors did not feel comfortable in the way they teach. Yeah, we're keeping on, keeping on.
Good for you. As expected, still a lot of question marks, and your website is the place to keep updated. That's probably overheating because you're using it so often.
Yes. And Facebook is a pretty good one, too, because we have events posted on there, and we're very quick at telling you that they've been rescheduled if they have.
Okay, wonderful. Deb Johnson, you're a great friend of WPR and Spectrum West. You're doing a marvelous job of adjusting. I didn't realize you were so flexible. But then I saw you twisting.
Yeah, then you saw me twisting. Oh, you got me. That was great.
Good,
I am flexible.
Good for you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
CVCA.net. That's their website. Remember all the wonderful venues that dot our landscape are working hard and hanging on, so however and whenever you can, patronize them in whatever ways are available and tell them you're behind them. Okay? Okay. Around the corner, we'll hear Ellen White do what she does so well, make music and make sense. Spectrum West on WPR. Thanks for being with us. Glad to have Jim Oliver on board this week. He found another book by an author, Neil Griffin, who has roots in where we live.
Neil Griffin enjoyed a steady diet of Joseph Wamba novels and the TV show Police Story as he was growing up in Eau Claire, the son of a philosophy professor. A graduate of Eau Claire Memorial High School, he looked forward to a career in law enforcement. He enlisted in the Marine Corps, in which he served for 8 years to enhance his chances of getting a job in police work. After the Marines, he landed a police job in Southern California, where he had a 27-year career as a patrol officer, a field training officer, SWAT, hostage negotiator, narcotics investigator, gang enforcement specialist, and supervisor of a homicide unit. In July of 2016, Neil retired as the senior lieutenant of a 150-officer department in Southern California, and he's converted from reading police novels to writing them. His most recent book, The Burden of Truth, was released in July, and Neil Griffin joins us by telephone from his home in Southern California to talk about his books. There are now 4 police novels. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Well, thank you, Jim. That was a very nice introduction. You pretty much summed it up, I think.
Okay, well, then we'll just quit right there and move on.
Yeah, I appreciate the invitation.
Tell us about the book. Not the ending, of course, but the rest of it.
Sure. No, this is a book that it hits very close to home for me. As the first 3 novels I've written have all been based in Wisconsin and purely fictitious, if you will. Whereas this book, The Burden of Truth, is based in the real community of Vista, California, which is here in San Diego County, with the protagonist being a part of a very real organization, the San Diego Sheriff's Office. So as I tell people, if you read The Burden of Truth, you can take any one of those police officer characters or even the civilian characters or the characters in the media, whichever ones you want, and you can pretty much pluck them out of the book and place them into the real world of San Diego County, and they'd be right at home. So I think the book is a real reflection of what life is like for a young man like Omar Ortega, who's growing up in the city of Vista, and doing what I say, walking the fine line, the middle lane of barrio street justice, if you will. He's got the cops on one side, and Macy, Omar, they wonder if this is one of the bad actors and perhaps a gang member, and that's how they treat him. When the gang members see Omar, they see a young man who should have already jumped in and should be putting in the work and paying the tax, as they'd say. So he's stuck in the middle, and he's in that world of go along to get along. And I met a lot of young men like Omar, and some of them in under really good circumstances and some of them not so good. So the story strikes close to my heart, and it's very true to life for me, and I'm anxious to share it with people.
a lot of questions about what's going on with police and minorities particularly, but anybody, I guess. We were having a conversation at home the other day about so many of the police officers live outside the city that they serve. Is that the case in Southern California?
It is the case, and it's the case nationwide. And not to prop myself up, but it was something that early on in my career, I just decided I always wanted to live in the community I served, and that's what I did. I worked for the Escondido Police Department in San Diego County, and I lived in that city and still do for my entire career because that was something that just was important to me. Now, a lot of police officers feel differently. They feel like they need to get away from those communities that they work in for a lot of different reasons, some personal safety, some just mental health, whatever it might be. But the bottom line is I think this figure is about 40% police officers currently reside in the jurisdictions they serve nationwide. And interestingly enough, I think it's worth pointing out, in Minneapolis, the number is more like, I believe it's like 14%. It's very low, one of the lowest in the country. And I do believe when we allow or we encourage police officers, and I shouldn't say allow because they certainly have the right to live wherever they want and commute, I think we should encourage police officers to be as close to the community they serve as possible. And I do think there's a correlation between what we're seeing is really a disconnect between a lot of urban centers and their police officers.
Isn't it true that some communities require their police officers to live within the city limits, or is that something of the past?
Yeah, perhaps once upon a time, but I don't know of any. And if they are doing it, it would be something that the police could easily challenge, because I believe that's been struck down in court, maybe at a management or an upper management level. But certainly the rank-and-file union-protected police officers have a right to commute in. And that doesn't mean that organizations can't create opportunities to encourage officers to live at least closer to the communities or, as some might say, within the sphere of influence of the community. But again, it's an individual decision, and cops make it for a lot of different reasons.
How does one encourage, then, a police officer to live in the city, or even at least feel like he's part of that community rather than being part of the community where he's physically living?
Well, one that we're familiar with here in Southern California is a take-home car policy. If you live within the jurisdiction or you live within a certain mileage of the jurisdiction, you're given a personalized patrol car, and you can take that home and park it in front of your house. And that way we see a lot of police cars throughout the community. And, of course, that's a huge benefit in terms of commuting and just expense. Now, a lot of cops would say, I don't want a police car parked in front of my house. Well, that's understandable, and I can appreciate that. And as a police officer who for years had a police car parked in front of his house, there were a number of occasions where, it wasn't necessarily positive for me. But I think overall it is something that, again, that's one way you can encourage police officers to live in their communities. And there's also, I've heard of a number of programs, for instance, in a place that is as expensive as San Diego in terms of home ownership. There are programs for first-time home buyers that are in public safety if they buy homes within their communities.
Well, this is your fourth book on policing. What were the first three?
I'm not sure when I really started getting the writing bug in there, but in 2015, after a number of years of wrestling with the idea of creating a story that what I like to say is will challenge people's assumptions about what they think they know about law enforcement. I think that's every writer's goal, is to challenge people's most basic assumptions. And when you're writing fiction, of course, you do that through the power of story and hopefully by entertaining people and writing a page-turner. So that was certainly my goal back in 2010, 2012, and I just stuck with it, and eventually I ended up going to writing conferences. I got a literary agent, and then I took a finished manuscript to market, and it was called Benefit of Doubt. And the Benefit of Doubt is actually a story of Ben Sawyer, who was a really great cop up in Oakland, California, until one day he just snapped and he commits an act of police abusive force that's just so egregious, he becomes that new poster boy for police brutality. And The Benefit of Doubt is kind of Ben Sawyer's road to redemption. So that was my first novel. It did very well. It listed on some bestseller lists, including the LA Times and some others, and that obviously resulted in a follow-up novel. And I ended up writing two more novels in that Newberg series that it's referred to as. And those novels kind of centered on a character by the name of Tia Suarez, who is a young female detective in the department, and readers responded very well to her. So those three books are all based in Wisconsin. And then the fourth novel, The Burden of Truth, is out here in San Diego.
So what are you working on now?
I have a novel now that's going to be published by Forge that, again, going way back to The Benefit of Doubt, there was a character in that book that was an older retired police officer. People who read the book may remember him, Lars Norgard. He had a very small role because he was, again, retired and he had had a serious illness. So I thought it'd be kind of fun to take Lars and kind of do a coming-of-age story of Lars Norgard. So this will be set in 1970, Milwaukee Police Department. I've been fortunate enough to talk to some former cops out of Milwaukee and start to get a flavor for the kind of book I want to write about that period of policing during the unrest of the 1960s and the Vietnam War in the background and that sort of thing. So just kind of getting my legs under me with that book, and I'm starting to have a lot of fun with it.
Well, great. You have a home also in Burnett County in Wisconsin around the area of Siren. Do you do some writing there, or do you do your writing at home?
I love to write up in Burnett, and it's so funny because we got back here a couple of days ago, and I think the thermostat topped out at about 109, and wildfires in the area. Couldn't help but take a peek at Burnett. I think it was 60 degrees, blue skies, and one of those beautiful Wisconsin autumn days that we all love. That was tough. But I love being in Burnett with my wife and family, and we get there as often as we can. And, it's a great writing environment, no doubt about it.
Well, we've been talking to Neil Griffin, author of The Burden of Truth, police novel, which is likely bound to soon be on the Los Angeles Times bestseller list, was released in July by Macmillan. It's available now from the usual online booksellers, and I know it's available at least one Eau Claire bookstore and probably others, so you can find it somewhere around here. Neil, thanks so much for being with us. I hope the book does well for you.
I appreciate it, Jim. Thanks for the invitation.
And we appreciate it. Jim Oliver, thank you. This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Charter Bank, offering fixed-rate mortgages, bridge loans, construction loans, and more. Loan officers Dawn and Susie are dedicated to providing personalized service. CharterBank.bank. Invested in partnerships. White resides in Portland, Oregon, quite an impressive music town, but singer and songwriter Ellen White loves Wisconsin, too. And up until this weird year, she's paid us a visit or two annually to entertain us at various venues, her favorite companions being Sue Orfield and her musical colleagues. Well, Portland has been in the news a lot lately, and since she's a friend and we haven't talked in a while, I thought hearing about her professional COVID constraints plus her Portlanders angle on their turbulence would be timely. We'll hear a bit more singing on the other side of our conversation.
It's late, I know.
I have to ask you about the accordion marching band.
What would you like to know? Did I survive it?
You did, obviously, but
really?
Was that the start of everything for you?
Oh, my gosh. Well, the start of everything for me was when my father realized that I had some measure of musical talent because I used to have this little tiny Jamar piano as a kid, and I used to plunk on that thing all the time pretending that I was playing with Duke Ellington and Count Basie, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I was just out there plunking notes. So it went from that. There was an accordion teacher. She started her own accordion school. It grew to 150 students in a matter of about 9 years. Part of the deal was that we played for all of these fraternal organizations. She had us gigging every week. Shriners to the Elks Club, to the Moose, to the Lions Clubs. At one point when I was 7 or 8 during one of our every Tuesday night rehearsals, she heard my voice, and I was the loudest singer in the whole group because I wanted attention, of course.
Oh, sure. I did for it.
I sang over everybody, over all the instruments, and she thought, I think I can get her up front, and she can do some solos. She lined up all these great Broadway tunes that I loved, and I just belted them out, everything from Hello, Dolly to Mame, Oklahoma, and, you know, all the Oscar and Hammerstein song hits. You know, it didn't exactly make friends over the years because I was socially ostracized, especially when I got in my teen years. It was not cool to play the accordion and try to be part of a counterculture, so one had to go.
What a great story. Here's the following question. I know you can still sing. Can you still play the accordion?
The accordion, but here's the deal. I can't do both. Too much time has gone by, but I still every now and then pull it out and just play, especially for my granddaughter, who loves it. She just thinks it's the coolest instrument on the planet.
Somewhere I read, and I'm sure it was online, probably on your website, the words, Ellen comes in many sizes.
And yes, body weight necessarily,
yes.
Although depending on, because of the pandemic, that might.
I was going to say, it's not healthy to do that. You should try to stay one size.
Yes, not yo-yo dieting. It's not a good.
Yeah, then I realized what they were really talking about. You play as a duo, you play trios, all the way up to a full nine-piece band with a horn section.
And it just depends on the gig, what the buyers can afford and what they want. In the last couple years, I'd say, you know, there isn't a huge budget anymore for having a bigger band.
Sure.
It seems like music has really been cut back a lot, and I think that's universal in most places.
Sure.
So having a smaller configuration, it seems to work better, and it's more economical and affordable for the buyer. You know, it keeps us working. It's sad because I just love the sound of the horns, you know, and having that big, huge sound behind me when I'm singing is thrilling. I've had the occasion to do it in Wisconsin with Sue's bigger band, where she's had those great horn players join us on some of the gigs that we've done while I've been out there, and that's been fun.
You are a Hall of Famer times two. 2002, the Cascade Blues Association Hall of Fame, and 2015, the Oregon Music Hall of Fame. The Oregon Music Hall of Fame includes people like Tim Hardin, Robert Cray, Jeff Lorber, the Kingsmen, Paul Revere and the Raiders, Doc Severinsen, whose real name is Carl, which I never knew.
I didn't know that either.
Mason Williams, remember Classical Gas from 1968.
Right.
Chris Bode, jazz instrumentalist. You must feel like you're in pretty good company. Way to go.
Well, it's very nice to be in that company. I didn't realize it was with Robert Cray as well. I was really surprised that I was nominated and then received the award. It's a real honor to put in the kind of work that you do, and you know, you spend most of your life trying to craft this career to as many different levels as you can and reinventing yourself and continuing to try to stay ahead of the curve with rehearsing and writing songs and coming up with new and interesting ways of presenting your music.
Yeah.
You know, all of that is taken into account. You have to just be ready to get on the wheel and roll with it, you know, and do what's next and right in front of you at the same time.
Yep.
It's an interesting career path, and it's one that chooses you. You don't choose it.
Yeah, I've heard that, yes. That's the speaking voice of Ellen White, and you undoubtedly have heard the singing voice. Singer-songwriter, she lives in Portland, Oregon, and it's time to get to the more serious stuff. Like all musicians, you have been handcuffed by this little old pandemic. Was it like everyone else? Along about March, things started to fall apart?
Yeah, March 13th, the day the music died. That's what we call it.
Yeah.
And sadly, there's not been a lot of movement in terms of getting venues open because our governor has put us in phase two, I believe it is. Some places are opened, but, you know, there's a lot of safety protocols that are in place. I have had 5 shows since July 4th. That's
wow.
it. And I lost a lot of work, a lot of work.
Yeah.
All the festivals were canceled. Events were canceled. it's the great unknown as to where this is going to end up. I have to hand it to a lot of people who've gotten pretty creative, you know, and are doing live streaming on Facebook, getting their work out there that way. I think it waxes and wanes, though. I have sort of noticed a little bit of a trend, not that I'm paying very close attention to it, but it just seems like, you know, some people have done it a few times and that was good. Another group will step in and do it for a while. And it's frustrating. It's sad that, you know, we've been cut off from doing the thing that we love the most. I know that the customers are hungry, that we've been hearing from them pretty regularly. When are we going to be able to see you again? Well, that when is the big question, when?
Yeah.
There's just no way of knowing, you know. There's rumors flying, 2022, maybe 2024. Mm. You know, I will tell you that from my personal experience, I'm actually grateful for this time off. For the last 10 years, I have been a runaway train with the work that I've been doing in the schools and also with performing and trying to keep up with just, you know, taking a breath here and there. I haven't had any downtime for a long time because I've really pushed myself. And this pandemic has shown me just how much I did. So I am gaining a new respect for, you know, having a quieter life right now. And it could be my age, too, you know, that I'm enjoying this particular time. And I also have a wonderful, a beautiful new granddaughter who's almost 9 months old. So I'm really getting a chance to spend time with her. And, you know, so I'm doing things that I wouldn't normally be doing if I were working and having my day completely filled up with activities from the minute I wake up to the minute I go to bed at night. So I think it's a healthy thing that I'm doing right now. I do miss it, though. I do miss being in the schools with the kids. I do miss performing with my friends. And it feels like, you know, well, I don't know what the projection is for this life right now. You know, we just don't know. It's just living in the moment really seems to be the norm. The 24 hours we've got, so what do we do with it?
We like having your perspective, and it appears as if it's a very healthy one. And the reason being, Wisconsin, West Wisconsin, is kind of your home away from home musically. And we wait for you to come back. Portland has been in the news a lot lately. After May 25th, the day George Floyd lost his life in Minneapolis, Portland got involved. And has been involved almost daily ever since. You know Portland well. What is it about your hometown? What's your take on why Portland feels as strongly as it does?
Well, I think there are a gazillion perspectives that if you asked anybody on the street, what is your take on what's going on? My take personally is that it no longer feels to me like there's protests going on in the civil rights movement sense of the word. You know, the peaceful protests of that era really made some strides in changing things. Jim Crow, ending the segregation, you know, opening up the doors that weren't open before. The Black Lives Matter, though, it started out with a very good intention, but it has evaporated because what's happening now is this violence has eclipsed it. And it is these nationalist groups that are getting involved. And, you know, today the first page on the news in my computer was that white supremacist groups in this area are down in Salem saying that they're going to kill Democrats. I mean, just hate begets hate. We know this. This is what we've been taught. Hate begets hate. What I would like to see is a conversation has to begin between these opposing groups with the unity groups to try and get people at the table to try to understand what is going on, to get into the solution, put the violence aside, lay down your weapons, come with the idea of meeting each other in the middle somewhere, compromise, do whatever it takes. Because without having a conversation, to continue to promote the violent actions is only going to make things worse. It's escalating. Even in my neighborhood, I'm seeing people getting a little bit testier than they used to be.
Sure.
And it concerns me. I'm concerned for the safety of every person in my region right now because it's escalating by the moment. And it's perpetuated in the social media. It's perpetuated on the news. You know, when we listen to the news, we're getting 5% of what's going on in the world. There's 95% of people doing really great things out there that we never hear about. Yeah. Never.
The tough part is, in order to sit down and talk or negotiate or compromise, many of us need role models on how to do that, and we don't have any.
Well, that's the thing. There are people in Portland who are considered to be strong leaders. Our Portland City Council is pretty strong, mm-hmm. and it's very diverse. And, you know, my husband suggested, Joanne Hardesty, who's one of the Portland City Council members, that they have a unity rally, which I love this idea, mm-hmm. a unity rally bringing out all the different leaders of color and persuasions and getting up there and talking to the masses about where we stand and where we would like to go.
Yeah.
And then from that point, clear the wreckage, get rid of all the violence that's going on in the street, which is not an easy task. It sounds very idealistic, I know, to say that. But it can be done, I think, if it were done smartly and in a timely way.
Hmm.
And then begin the conversations.
Yeah.
Having regular town forums, regular meetings. And I'm talking, you know, twice a month, once a month, but keep it going. Don't let this notion pass where we have to have these movements have to be moving forward. They can't be stagnant and standing still,
no.
or nothing is going to change.
I think a lot of people are thinking the way you are thinking. However, sadly, it feels as if something catastrophic has to happen before we do these things.
Hasn't that already taken place?
Oh, certainly. If you're a sensible person, you'd say that. But there are people out there who feel like, oh, no, it hasn't gone far enough yet. You have some wonderful suggestions, and what you ought to do is, you're probably doing it because I know your husband's involved
right.
with the Oregon Center for Public Policy,
mm-hmm.
and so
yes.
he's a founding member of that, so I'm sure you guys talk about that a lot, and I mean, you're not somebody who sits on your hands. I'm sure you are doing what you can to facilitate the kind of positive things you were talking about, but do you feel kind of helpless? And this is maybe Pollyanna-ish, but do you think music, you as a musician, can help in some way?
Oh, absolutely. I see no reason why we couldn't. In fact, there is a gentleman who presented this group called Musicians United. Ever since 2016, he has had different people come on his program.
Hmm.
We've been writing protest songs. We've been writing songs about change. We've been writing songs about the hope for the future, motivating, moving people forward, all kinds of things. So I really think that music is foundational in this movement.
Okay.
I really do. And I think it can be paired with any speaker out there who is like-minded and trying to move things more towards a peaceful coexistence.
Yeah. I've asked a lot of musicians who I've spoken with, people who were active, and I said, you know, back in the day when social upheaval was happening in the 60s and 70s, the protest song was huge.
It was at the heart of it. It was the gasoline that made the engine go.
And it made people think. Music causes emotion that isn't there when you're just screaming at one another, and it can have a calming effect. So,
Absolutely.
You know, and I've asked them, where did the protest song go? Don't you think we need them again?
Mm-hmm.
And they all kind of say, yeah, you know, maybe we do.
I agree. I think it's good because these songs encapsulate what's going on in our times.
Mm-hmm.
And if nothing else, it's for the record. And down the road, 100 years from now, 200 years from now, this is going to be an integral part of our history, is to look at the music that was created around the historical events that happened. And the narratives from the people as well are encapsulated in songs. So I see it as being really foundational for these times, absolutely.
And it's amazing how protective grandchildren can make you.
Oh, don't have to tell me that. My heart has already been stolen,
yeah.
and I'm not getting it back.
No, good. Good for you. I knew we'd love your perspective, and thanks so much for taking the time, because Western Wisconsin knows you well and loves you. And as soon as Portland, you know, hit the news, I said, I have to talk to Ellen White eventually, and I'm glad you consented to do so. Keep your fingers crossed and your eye on the on the road ahead, and we'll be watching, and I'll look for your face in one of these wonderful confabs that make a difference. Good
Thank
for you.
Thank you, Al, and my best to everybody in Wisconsin, too. I love everybody out there. I've had such a great family experience in getting to know the lovely people of the Midwest, and I do feel it's like my home away from home, and I wish everybody the best in staying safe and, you know, just continue to try to put those positive thoughts out there. Do something, just something small, whether it's opening a door for somebody. That is a step forward as far as I'm concerned.
That's
the littlest things can actually make the biggest difference.
Good advice, and we look forward to seeing you again when the sun comes back up.
All right. Thanks so much, Al. All the best.
From the first time that I saw you, I wanted you for my own. There was something that seemed to tell me you didn't want to be alone. I was falling.
Well, you can't leave a conversation with Ellen White before you let her wail, and I think she just did that. What do you think? Hey, so many people to thank for making this all possible each week. Dean, Kate, Catherine, Jim, and you guys. Next week, a screenwriter from around here has a new movie out. Another arts association has plans. We'll hear about them. A book about Wisconsin legends and weird stuff, and more. I'm Al Ross. Between now and then, be safe. Take care of each other. Do the best you can. See you next week. Bye now.